This MP3 audio is of Dr. George Blue Spruce Jr. and was recorded during his Searching for My Destiny book signing on June 26, 2010, at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Dominic Pruitt recorded, edited, and produced this audio. Now to Dr. Blue Spruce Jr.
Sangi Salmo, I can't tell you how pleased I am to be here this afternoon from the standpoint of it, the ceremony attracting and bringing into this room familiar faces, friends, family, relationships, fellow tribes people. I get a chance to talk around the United States, and I talk to hundreds of other tribal people, and it's always a unique and distinct and honorable pleasure to be among my own. I see such familiar faces, people that have been role models to me through the years. I see Dr. Joe Sando here. I see contemporaries, people that I have held in high regard. I see Herman Agoyo here, his beautiful wife. I see childhood friends of mine and children and grandchildren of them that I grew up with, the Santa Fe Indian School. And I'm looking at Upton Ethelba, and I'm looking at dear relatives, and I see so many of them, and like I refuse to do like some Academy Award winners do, they get up and start thanking and they forget somebody. So I'm just going to say I thank every one of you for being here. I want to pay special thanks to the management of the Cultural Center to sponsor this event and let us use the facilities. And I especially want to, and this is going to be hard for me because it's a tender thank you to my only brothers, daughter and son, Roxanne and Sean, who are so special to me, not only unto themselves, but through my wonderful brother that I adored and loved dearly. At this point, I would like to introduce somebody that is so meaningful in my life. I am so blessed to have such a beautiful and wonderful wife as my dear Patricia. Patricia is an Oklahoma Indian, and she comes from three tribes in northeastern Oklahoma, the Quapaw, the Yuchi, and Cherokee tribes. And every time I meet somebody who comes from multiple tribes, I think of my friend that was part Chickasaw, part Potawatomi, and part Wallapai. And I used to say, Jake, that makes you chicken pot pie. Mrs. Bruce and I, we have six daughters and one son. I'll forget the daughters for a moment because I could go on and on, but I'll just brag on the son. Dwayne Blue Spruce, if you see the museum just opposite the cathedral in Santa Fe, New Mexico, my son established that museum that used to be the old Santa Fe post office. My son then went on to become one of the architects and was the construction manager for the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. And when it opened in September of 2004, our family were VIPs. We got to go into the doors first. We got to be quartered here and there as very, very important people, thanks to our son. We also now have 9 granddaughters and 3 grandsons. And 2 of the grandsons and 1 of the granddaughters are interested in going into the health field. And if we keep on encouraging them enough, hopefully they might even become dentists like their grandfather. The writing of this book took 3 years. 2 years in the actual writing, and then 1 year where it had to go to an international editorial review board to give their blessing to the University of Nebraska Press, stating whether or not they thought it should be published. That took the longest time because there was one editor that just procrastinated and procrastinated. Finally, they said, we need your remarks on this book so we can go ahead with publishing or not. And he said, we've had enough books about American Indians, so I don't want to see another book published. So they had to send it out to another editor, and that editor came right back and said, yes, go ahead with the publication. I don't think I would have ever done this on my own, but Mrs. Blue Spruce said, you know, I'm beginning to hear people say, especially students and people, instructors, principals at different schools saying, has Dr. Blue Spruce written a book? Because if he had, he should. Then I'm the assistant dean of the dental school in Arizona, and the students, when they hear me and laugh at my corny jokes, etc., they always wonder if I had written a book, and I was always saying no. Mrs. Blue Spruce finally encouraged me that it's time that you share your story because I think it'll influence readers. But the exciting cause, the thing that flicked the switch that said, I'm going to start doing it, was when I was at a conference 5 or so years ago in Las Vegas, and I heard a person come up to the podium and started taking credit for things that my brother did back in the late 1960s and in the early 1970s. He was the co-founder of the Association of American Indian Physicians, and these people were starting their history of this organization in the 1980s, when my brother had already been there 11 years before. At that same conference, I heard another man taking credit for what I had done. That took me out of my chair, and I went to the podium and I said, correction, please. And I set the record straight. I believe I came home and I said to Patricia, I'm ready to write my story. 15 years ago, a lady called me on the telephone and she interviewed me for a story she was writing, and she was contacting American Indian health professionals, and she was steered to me, and over the telephone she interviewed me and she wrote a book. It was American Indian Healers. And she featured me in the book, and she said, sometime you ought to write your story. She says, I would be honored if you would call upon me to do it. She's a professional writer. She's written dozens of children's books. And so, having had her give me permission to contact her, I figured the best way to go would be somebody who had a lot of contacts and who knew the ins and outs of publishing a book. She also was this wonderful individual that she would delve into my mind. If I said something somewhat superficially, she wanted to know more detail. And so I credit her with a lot of anecdotes in the book where she drew out of me stories that I would have otherwise not mentioned. I'm going to very quickly, and I timed myself on this. It only takes a minute if I do it fast. But it's the summary inside the cover, and it goes like this. George Blue Spruce Jr. is recognized as the first American Indian dentist in the United States. His life story reaches back to the ancient Pueblo culture cherished by his grandparents and parents and extends to the state-of-the-art dentistry and the current needs of the American Indian people. Blue Spruce's journey begins on the Santa Fe Indian School campus with his parents' determination that their children would excel academically and obtain college degrees. After graduating from dental school, Dr. Blue Spruce planned to return to the Pueblos to treat his people. As it turned out, his destiny reached far beyond, from the wilds of Montana to New York City to San Francisco to South America and back to the United States. In Washington, D.C., he presented the needs of American Indians to Congress and lunched with the president. Throughout his journey, Dr. Blue Spruce has traveled between two cultures, succeeding in mainstream society while keeping Pueblo tradition in his heart. Facing prejudice and conquering adversity, he reached the zenith of his career as director of the Phoenix Regional Indian Health Service and achieving the rank of Assistant Surgeon General of the United States. George Blue Spruce is the founder of the Society of American Indian Dentists and serves as an assistant dean at the Arizona School of Dentistry and Oral Health. I want to share several stories, and I think I'm doing this specifically for the students that are here, about what I've tried to tell in the early chapters of my book. If we can now, all for a moment, go back 61 years, September 1949, downtown Santa Fe, New Mexico, the old Greyhound bus depot right across from the old Loretto church there. It's 2 a.m., and I don't know why that early in the morning I'm boarding a Greyhound bus. And my folks are there to say goodbye to me. And I remember, just as I was about ready to board the bus, my dad said something most profound. He said, "Son, when you board that bus and you leave us today, you'll never be home again to stay." And it didn't hit me till I was near Las Vegas, and then I realized the impact of his words, that I'm leaving home never to return as a member living in that household. I think I cried from Las Vegas to Raton. And I know when I got off at Raton, I wrote a postcard. I wrote another postcard in Denver when I was transferring buses to Cheyenne, Wyoming. And then I wrote another postcard in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And all of them were already citing how lonely I was. And by the time I wrote the one in Cheyenne, it was, "I want to come home." 27 hours later, I arrive in Omaha, Nebraska, the largest city I had ever been in my life. I walk out the Greyhound bus depot. I had a little brown Samsonite luggage, and I stood there, visibly showing how lost I was. And a kind lady put me on the streetcar, rode with me, and took me out to Creighton University. And I became the first American Indian to ever attend Creighton University. People began to hear there's this American Indian over at Wareham Hall, freshman dormitory for pre-med and pre-dental students. And they heard that I was from Santa Fe, New Mexico. So students used to stop me on the sidewalk and say, "Oh, you're that fella from Mexico? You see many bullfights down there? And are there any of you that remember the term ROTC, Reserve Officers Training, that you were required to take in college? They came up to me and said, "Boy, are you lucky. You don't have to take ROTC." And I asked why, and they said, "Foreigners don't have to take ROTC." That was bad enough, but when they found out that I was Indian, I was to be the instant expert on all American Indians around the country. It was like, you've seen one Indian, you've seen them all. And then the naive stereotype questions like, was I born and raised in a teepee? Did my mother carry me on her back? But the killer was when the Chamber of Commerce in downtown Omaha were sponsoring their big May Day parade, and they heard that there's this American Indian at Creighton University, and they came out to the school and they asked me if I would consider putting on Indian regalia and riding a pinto pony at the head of the parade. I said, "I got an exam to take. I don't have time for this." But that was something that was really an impact in those first few weeks. And then I find out that I may end up being in Omaha, Nebraska at Creighton University for 8 years, because they said that's how long it's going to take to become a dentist. And I started adding up the years, and I said, I'll be dead before that. And if that wasn't bad enough, here comes the school newspaper, the Creightonian. And just prior to that, I am hearing that Creighton receives over 1,000 applications for every single seat in dental school. And so there were going to be over 1,000 applications, and they were only going to accept 46. And I was there when the World War II GIs were coming back from conflict in World War II. And they were getting preferential treatment. They were coming through under what they used to call the GI Bill of Rights. They got scholarships to go to school. And a lot of my fellow students in pre-dent and pre-med, they were these World War II veterans. So there was pressure right there to compete with all these World War II veterans. And then the school newspaper comes with a photographer and their pads and everything. We hear that you're the only American Indian here at Creighton. We also hear that you're interested in going to dental school. Well, we've kind of done some research, and we think that if you do get into dental school, if you do get into dental school, and if you graduate from dental school, you could very well be the first identified American Indian to ever graduate from dental school. So the pressure's on. That first Thanksgiving, all of my classmates, they took off for home. Iowa, Missouri, the Dakotas, Kansas, etc. I couldn't go home. It was too far. Didn't have a telephone. So if you could die of homesickness or loneliness, I was your role model, because I was so lonesome. And what did I do to occupy that first Thanksgiving away from home? And our family was so close. We always had Thanksgiving and wonderful time. I'm still a movie buff, and I'm looking at my niece, and she knows how much I love movies to this day. But I went to a movie theater, and for a quarter, I went in and saw two movies, bag of popcorn, and a Hershey bar with almonds that I still love to this day. I came out of that movie theater after having seen a double feature and went to White Castle and got six hamburgers for $1. went back into another movie theater for another quarter, saw two more movies, another bag of popcorn, and a Hershey bar with almonds. By this time, it was near midnight. I got back to the dormitory, fell asleep, and that was my first Thanksgiving away from home, and I almost died. Then I get drafted, and I need that like a hole in the head. Because the Korean conflict was on the horizon, and my generation, 18 years old, they were drafting us in anticipation of that conflict. Was somewhere in small print, there was the item that if you were going to medical school or if you were going to dental school, those doctors would be needed to serve these troops when the war came, so they gave us deferments. And even though I wasn't in dental school yet, they gave me a deferment. And I thank the Great Spirit for giving me that break, as it were, because I lost three of my high school classmates killed in the Korean conflict. So I count my blessings for being exempt. Things were pretty rough that first year. I remember some of those classes were like mystery hours to me. I didn't know what the instructor was saying, and I had to have tutoring and everything. And I did pretty well at St. Michael's, but geez, the courses I was taking for pre-dent and pre-med were just really, really tough. And I went out for the tennis team because I played tennis at St. Michael's. I went to the state tournament in 1949 here in Albuquerque. And I was the only freshman that made the tennis team. And I lettered as a freshman at Creighton. And then in the school newspaper, in the sports sections, it was saying, Blue Spruce defeats so-and-so from Nebraska. Blue Spruce beats so-and-so from Iowa. Blue Spruce beats somebody from South Dakota. Then my picture came out in the paper again, and I was kind of like big man on campus. And all of a sudden, I was beginning to bring back my self-worth, got more motivated, and I guess the rest is history, because I did go on to become a dentist. How many times in my life have I been asked that direct question? How did you become a dentist? I have a daughter that used to say, Daddy, I just asked you the time, not how you make the watch. And it's because I like to elaborate on my stories. And this I will elaborate a little bit, but I got to give you a background. Talking about my mother and father, my mother coming from Okeawenge, my dad coming from Powhatan, and they're forced into the federal boarding school system at the turn of the 1900s, and they went to Albuquerque Indian School right across the street here. And my dad graduated in 1925, and my mother graduated a couple years later. But they came to this school not knowing how to speak, read, or write English. Mama spoke Tewa, Daddy spoke Carison. They mixed them here together, and they were forced to speak English. That was the forced assimilation period. Mama went back to the reservation or back to the Pueblo, and Daddy wanted to continue school. He liked it. He was a big man on campus, Mama used to say. They used to march around like military. They had World War I military uniforms. Everything was regimented. And my dad was a battalion commander, and my mother had her eyes set on him. And Daddy thought Mama was the most beautiful. He always said that the Okeawenge girls were the most beautiful. That's what he always used to say to us about Mama. Anyway, she went back to Okanagan, and Daddy had to fight his family at Powhatan because my grandfather, his father, wanted him to stay and herd the sheep, help him with the crops, help him take care of the family. He was the only boy in the family. But he had two sisters that worked as domestics here in Albuquerque. They had a chance to go to Albuquerque High. And they said, they convinced my grandma and grandpa to allow my daddy to go on and get a skilled, a marketable skill trade. And so he went to Haskell in Lawrence, Kansas, and became a refined cabinet maker. He came back. He was hired by the Fred Harvey Company that was building the railroad depots from here to Los Angeles. He was making cabinetry for them. He got hired by a BIA official in 1930 and went to the Santa Fe Indian School, and he and Mama spent 27 years there. I was born at the old Indian Hospital in 1931. My brother was born there in 1934, and my sister was born there in 1944. Well, every 2 years, Daddy used to come home. He was upset. He was frustrated. And he used to say, here I am with all these years of experience. Here I am, an American Indian. Here I am, gifted in the trade that I'm teaching these students. And every 2 years, I get a new boss. And this new boss is non-Indian, and is probably half his age, knows nothing about what they're dealing with in coming to the Santa Fe Indian School, and they're my dad's boss. And so he said, out of frustration, our mission, Mama, is to assure that our children get that piece of paper that allows them to get better pay, get more recognition, and get more benefits. They're going to get a college degree. Years later, he used to say, Mama, we didn't do so bad. Two reservation kids that couldn't speak, read, or write English. And here, we've produced two doctor sons and a daughter who's a ballerina with a master's degree. And he had reason to be proud. And so, the next thing was, and I'm coming to the answer to that question, why did you become a dentist? And it was that Daddy used to make sure that my brother Burl and I participated in teenage events in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And they used to have bicycle derbies, soapbox derbies, sponsored by the Chevrolet Motor Company and the Optimist Club. And there was always this one man that was always in charge. Everybody respected him. He was looked upon for leadership, and he was the one that made sure that everything functioned properly. I was this kid that one of the first words I learned in Tewa was, Hun hunatumu. And that means, boy, is he fat. I was this fat little kid that had this low self-esteem, really, really shy. And this very important man came up to me right before my race, and he puts his arm around me and he says, George, I know you're going to be a winner today, and I'm going to be rooting for you. And I looked at this man in awe and admiration. His name was Dr. Gaylord Renfro. He was a big dentist in town. And I said, I want to be like him. And then I find out later that he was a dentist. When he finds out that I want to be a dentist, he befriends me and has me come to his office in Santa Fe and observe him treating patients. He was just a wonderful man in promoting my motivation. So the folks, the next thing is, let's go see a counselor. Our son wants to be a dentist, and let's get some instructions on what he needs to do. This counselor said, your mother and dad George and Juanita Blue Spruce, you say they're cabinet maker, cook at the Santa Fe Indian School. You're an American Indian. Well, let me tell you, your folks will never be able to afford to send you to college, much less dental school. You know, Indians don't go to college, and those Indians that do go to college, they always flunk out. So maybe you ought to think about something that'll mature you before you think of college, like, why don't you join the service? Well, my dad walked out of that meeting just in anger, and he said, just for that, we're going to prove that you are going to become a doctor. And so then the next thing was finances. And I graduated as valedictorian of my high school graduation class, St. Michael's, and they had a scholarship in 1949 for all valedictorians to compete by writing an essay about what they were going to do with this $300 scholarship that the New Mexico Elks Association was going to bestow. And I won. And the next thing, my mother and I are going to Carlsbad to receive my $300 scholarship award. I'm sitting at the front table, and there's a picture somewhere of me full of pimples and just like the ugliest person to be sitting up at the front desk. And I'm sitting right next to the grand exalted ruler of the National Elks Association. And I guess he's asking me questions, etc. So it comes time where he's going to give me the $300. He gets up to the podium, and as if it was this evening, I can still vividly hear him saying, wouldn't it be wonderful if the New Mexico Elks Association could help this Indian boy go to college? Here's what I'm going to do. For every dollar that the New Mexico Elks Lodge has pledged towards his pre-dental education, we at the national level in Chicago will pitch in $2. So I got enough money to enter college and begin my pre-dental. It wasn't hard, and I had to work, and the first job I got, I looked at a posting in our freshman dormitory and said, chauffeur needed. So I went to our dormitory phone. There was only one phone in the dormitory. And I called, and this lady wanted to interview me because I was the first one to call. And it was a real rich lady in Omaha, Nebraska, that her husband died and left her with a 1949 great big massive black Cadillac. And she wanted somebody to drive her around the outskirts of Omaha and the cornfields. And that was my first job at Creighton University. And all I remember about that was she was such a mean lady. And she probably paid me just peanuts. But anyway, I went on to take another job in a toy factory where I helped manufacture toys. And then I was assigned to that department where just after the castings came off, I had to file off the rough edges of this metal, and it was going to be the bottom of the toy irons for girls to iron their doll clothes. So I had that job for a while, and then I heard, hey, you know where they really pay good money is in the meatpacking houses. And I went down to the Swiss packing house in Omaha, Nebraska, and I got a job there. And I remember in August of 1952, the whistles all over the meatpacking plant were whistling, and we all came to a stop. And they declared over the loudspeaker that Omaha, Nebraska had now become the beef capital of the world. We surpassed Chicago. Well, I rose through the ranks in the packing house. I was in the sheep kill, the beef kill. But when we became the leaders, the beef capital of the world, we were slaughtering over 800 heads of cattle a day. And then when I got into what they called the beef lugging, I was making overtime because us beef luggers would bring out the cold quarters of beef from the storage lockers and load them onto the railroad cars so that the beef could be shipped around the United States. And this afternoon, and maybe I'm calling upon Sean here as to my memory, one of the things I never forgot was that we had four kinds of beef. There was the RQ, reduced quality, and then there was the commercial, which was next to reduced quality, and then we had the good, and then we had the choice. But boy, the one that was the best of all was the prime. And to this day, the prime stays in Omaha and the rest is shipped out around the country. That's why Omaha is so famous for its steak. Well, I'm coming to an end now, but I wanted to elaborate some of my stories because I knew the students were going to be here. And I want to end on searching for my destiny. When I was a clinician, I worked with the 8 northern pueblos before they had running water, before they had electricity, except in the day school. And the principal used to let me do my dentistry with World War I and World War II portable. And she used to put me out in the bathroom because that's the place that I wouldn't be disturbing the students while they were in school. So I went from bathroom to bathroom among the 8 northern pueblos when I was their dentist. Then my dad remembers I was with the U.S. Public Health Service, and he remembers, well, where are they sending you now? You're doing really good with the northern pueblos. And I said, well, there's those Gros Ventres and Assiniboines in north central Montana that need a dentist. And so they're in such need of a dentist, they were ordering you there. So while I was in Montana, I worked with the Blackfeet, the Chippewa, the Cree, the Sioux, the Lame Deer, the Crows, the Northern Cheyennes. So I really got familiar with tribal dental programs, to which I was probably the first to initiate many of these. And here's where I began to find, I guess, the first part of searching for my destiny. I gave a speech, and in my book there's a picture of me giving that speech at Lexington, Kentucky, when I, for the first time, decided to tell the real story from my perspective about the needs of American Indians as far as their health care, more specifically, their dental care. Then I made another speech at the American Dental Association annual conference in 1963 on the boardwalk at Atlantic City, and I walked out of there and I thought I was Elvis Presley for everybody's wanting to hear more about what I had to say about the atrocities of health care on Indian reservations. The Surgeon General was there of the U.S. Public Health Service, heard my remarks, and he said, we want you to become an administrator of American Indian programs, but you have to go back to school. And I had sworn when I got out of dental school, I would take another exam. I would never take another exam, write another paper. And here I am back at the University of California at Berkeley, right in the middle of the student unrest. The Black Panthers were pulling me this way, the other militants pulling me this way, because once again, I was the only Indian there at the School of Public Health, and they were putting a megaphone in front of my mouth and say, talk about the atrocities of the American Indian. And I'm saying, I got an exam to take. Leave me alone. And I was like the oldest guy in the class asking for tutoring from these young 18, 19-year-olds. And then I gave a talk at the University at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. And that's the one that launched me, took me out of dentistry, and took me on into being the promoter and the director of many national programs in Washington, D.C. And when it says I had lunch with the president, it was right after Nixon had resigned and Gerald Ford took over. Well, Gerald Ford became a friend of mine because he relied on me to give him data and facts and figures about American Indians. And I'll end with this story. I see that you're laughing at some of my stories. This one is one of my favorite ones. When I was made director of the Native American programs in 1974, they were closing up the old Office of Economic Opportunity, and they were bringing all the staff over to what was then Health, Education, and Welfare. And my office was having to take all of these misfits that really didn't deserve to be in these various programs. And first thing I said to my new secretary was, when Indian tribes come to visit me, under no circumstances are you to disturb me. When we're meeting in the conference room, it's like I'm meeting with presidents. I'm meeting with people that lead sovereign nations, just like presidents and kings of foreign nations. Do not disturb me. After meeting with these Pueblo tribal leaders for about 2 hours, we break up and I go over to my desk, and there's my telephone messages that had come in, and I start looking through them, and I come to this one, and I look up at my secretary. Her name was Peggy, and she says, "Yes, Dr. Blue Spruce, the president called you." "But you said not to disturb you." And when I called back President Ford, he laughed because he was a jovial guy. And he used to answer and make his own phone calls. He said, "George," he says, "if you ever fire Peggy, I want to hire her." My time is up, and I thank you for your attention.